You're listening to Nick Luck Daily, bringing you the latest news and the best interviews from around the world of horse racing. This episode is brought to you by the Racehorse Owners Association, by Thoroughbred Racing Commentary's Global Rankings in partnership with the Saudi Cup, and by the Fitzdares Club. Hi there, welcome to the show, bringing you the latest news and sharpest insight from around the world of horse racing every weekday. It is Friday, February the 26th. We are nearly in March. Spring seems nearly to be here finally. It is blue sky and bright here in TW11 today. I'm feeling in very chipper mood. And just a few miles down the road, the ground is drying out all the time at Kempton Park. The jump racing tomorrow could have a very different feel to it. And with that in mind, I have posted a call to Paul Nichols, who talks you through his runners at Kempton tomorrow and Fontwell on Sunday. And there are loads of them. And he talks to me about why he is sending a slightly smaller team to the Cheltenham Festival this year as well. Switching codes, and James Willoughby provides his weekly Friday reflections on what's been happening on the global stage with a view to the Thoroughbred Racing Commentary World Rankings, and he talks the Saudi Cup and how high Mishrif might go on turf and or dirt this season. I'm very much looking forward to that. And given the fact that we've spent a long time during the last few months debating the ethics of gaming machines and their role in supplying racing's finances, I think you'll be quite interested in an interview that I've conducted with Senator Damon Thayer, Kentucky State Senator, who has been instrumental in pushing through a bill in Kentucky to enable historic horse racing machines, slot machines essentially, to have their take scooped up by the pari-mutuel and thereby bolster horse racing's coffers and, as he describes it, provide a blue sky vision for Kentucky horse racing. I'll be fascinated to hear your thoughts on that. But first of all, a roundup of today's news. Dave Yates once again joins me from the Daily Mirror. Yates, you were with me earlier in the week and we were talking about the possibility of the Grand National moving back. That is not going to happen. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, that didn't take very long, Nick, did it? On Tuesday, I said that I thought it wasn't a no-brainer, but there was a compelling case for moving the National from April the 10th, 48 hours back to April the 12th, so that betting shop punters could wager on the race. This has been thrown out pretty quickly by the Jockey Club. I would liken this to your neighbour knocking on your door and saying, "Mr. Luck, would you mind moving your E-type Jag a couple of doors down the road? I'll give you £100, but I need the space for a removal van." The £100 wouldn't change your life, but it would come in handy. I think that probably racing would have been looking for about £1.5 million from the retail aspect of betting on the Grand National. That, at least if the 2019 version is any guide. Just bear in mind that the levy board reserves, they were reduced from £50 million to £30 million, so by 40% up to the end of 2020 by the coronavirus pandemic. We've had a further 8 weeks of damage since then. So £1.5 million, it wouldn't have solved the issue, but it would have come in very handy. I've great respect for Dick and White of the Jockey Club, who's been a racing administrator pretty much for as long as I've been around. There are a couple of quotes, however, that I took slight issue with. He said there is not a solid enough basis to move one of the biggest racing fixtures in the calendar just 6 weeks out. Well, I mean, they move fixtures all the time, including the big ones. So that doesn't really wash with me. Dickens said whether there is a financial upside for the sport, well, it's not really a case of whether. There definitely would have been a financial upside. And he also said whether it's responsible to cause a rush on betting shops just as they open again, whether that was a good thing. My response to that would be if betting shops, if bookmaking chains haven't already got procedures in place to keep their clients and their staff safe, well, they shouldn't be in business in the first place. But I take all those on board. The Jockey Club said they had taken everyone's opinions on board, but they've decided not to move it. Personally, I disagree with them, but it's not something that kept me awake last night.
Presumably, the more compelling reason not to do this was the fact that the date, the government, the DCMS, keep messaging sports saying these dates are not set in stone. They could be moved back at any time. That would be the one thing that would worry me more than any of the above.
Yeah, that's very true. There is, as Dickon also said in his quotes, I mustn't shortchange him, that there is a fluidity and an uncertainty with the dates involved. So, of course, you could reschedule the race for April the 12th, put all those arrangements in place, and then find that maybe, I don't know, possibly putting the schools back at one swipe, that triggers an upturn in cases, and therefore that those figures have to be changed. So that's definitely would be towards the front of their thinking. Yeah. I think that there's a reputational thing as well, and that does irritate me, because I think that for 11 months now, racing has had to almost single-handedly carry the can in the media for the fact that the Cheltenham Festival took place, Crufts took place, rugby internationals took place, international football Champions League matches took place as well. And that's well, I say it's starting to get irritating. It was irritating, I think, about 10 months ago. It's beyond the pale now. But I'm a journalist, and so I can maybe be a bit less cautious with these things than racing politicians. I think all politicians start from the most cautious square on the board and then negotiate their way out of it. In this instance, as you say, the fact that the dates aren't set in stone, the possibility of reputational damage, which, again, you know, I think we've gone too far with that now, those were uppermost in their minds. And that's why the race is going to stay as it is. So it's betting online and on your smartphone only.
OK, I just want to talk about some of the dates, because everyone's just missing the dates, aren't they? The entry is just before the next phase of retail reopening, hence the conversation we've just been having. Ascot is just before that magic date of the 21st of June, the last phase of unlocking some of the lockdown restrictions. And the Chester May meeting, which was leading the way, trying to get crowds back, is just before the date, May the 17th, for getting some crowds back onto the track. Chester trying to perhaps hold trial events. Doncaster talking about being up for holding trial events soon. That doesn't reckon with owners, who are a sort of separate group that I think the BHA and the ROA are trying to get back on a race course sometime in March, but I doubt in time for the Cheltenham Festival.
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating. I suppose racing's opponents will say this is karma, won't they, for the Cheltenham Festival taking place. There was a really rather vindictive piece in The Guardian about that a week ago. Save yourself the trouble of reading it, I would. I don't think that in this instance, although this is extremely frustrating, if we're going to talk about the reputational side of things, I think this is just something that we're going to have to swallow. On Tuesday, you spoke to Nick Smith of Ascot about the possibility of moving the meeting backwards. I think the upshot of that was that nothing is ruled in and nothing is ruled out. But it's very frustrating. As you say, it's a matter of a couple of days in many cases, whereby the floodgates open seemingly on June the 21st. There isn't a, obviously there is a phased way of doing things because it's in four steps, but the fact that Ascot is 2 days outside, it just means that it misses out on a full crowd by 2 days. As things stand, there's nothing that can be done about that. It's very frustrating, but I think in this instance, we're just going to have to put up with it.
Okay, let's talk about yesterday, because Nicky Henderson staged what would normally have been his press day. He had to do it virtually. It was a long and detailed procedure. What are the headlines out of there, Dave, briefly?
Right, well, I think there were two mainly that made my ears prick up. The first was not altogether unpredictable, and that was Nicky Henderson saying that this was probably going to be the toughest year ever. I tried to tempt him into using the word underdog, which of course would have been a strange one for a trainer who had all those winners in 2012, but he didn't go for that. But he did say that Altior may wear cheek pieces in the Queen Mother Champion Chase. He said that this had been discussed. It was under consideration. Obviously, they'd ruled out the Ryanair over 2 miles and 5 for the horse. They're going to go for a third victory in the Queen Mother Champion Chase over the 2 miles. He felt that the horse was inclined to race lazily at Kempton over Christmas when second to Nube Negra in the Desert Orchid Chase. And so they're thinking of putting cheek pieces on Altior. I think that when connections tend to go public with a possible plan about headgear and such like for horses, that plan inevitably and invariably comes to fruition. So I suspect we will see Altior with the Elvis-style sideburns at Cheltenham on March the 17th.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the key story I took away from that press conference. Let me talk to you about Ashin Murphy, who is most of the way through serving his suspension from France Gallo for testing positive for a metabolite of cocaine. He's been on the PR advance the last couple of days in an interview with Charlie Webster on sportinglife.com. Excellent interview as well. And in the trade paper today and in the Sun today, talking about can't wait to return, get a few days under his belt, and then perhaps offer a big money meeting in Dubai. But if that's on the red list, it'll mean 10-day hotel quarantine when he comes back. So that might not happen.
No, I mean, well, obviously the ban was for 3 months, wasn't it? The France Gallo, they'd essentially accepted part of the jockey's explanation, but also held him culpable for ingesting the substance. So that's why the ban was 3 months instead of 6, which it could have been. So, I mean, in terms of the reputational damage to Ashin Murphy, I think he's emerged from this largely unscathed. He's missed the least remunerative 3 months of the year, probably, for a British-based jockey anyway. And so if he can come back and then start riding in the big races in early spring, then he can pretty much pick up where he left off. Memories are short in this sport. He's still a young man. He's at the start of his career. He's not at the start of his career, but he's certainly a long way from the finish of it. He has broken the rules. He's been punished for that. And I hope that we won't be seeing a repeat of this, because up until now, it's been a career that's just been up and up.
Well, no rest for Paul Nicholls and his team this weekend. A really busy weekend at Fontwell on Sunday and more immediately at Kempton tomorrow. And Paul joins me now. Paul, I just thought it was well worth catching up, because if a lot of people are going quiet for a bit, you are full steam ahead and pedal to the metal this weekend.
Yeah, that always is where, you know, we had a quiet January. Well, probably a few more winners than normal for us in January, but if we get quiet and the weather's out of that, but we got lots of horses to run. I mean, we've got a smaller squad to go to Cheltenham, so the rest of them are all going to be running. And yeah, I think we've got 6 or 7 at Fontwell Sunday, 6 actually, and I think 9 at Kempton on Saturday. So a busy weekend, which is what we like.
I mean, is that just a function of circumstance, the fact that you got a smaller team at Cheltenham and more horses for the other races, or was it a deliberate policy from the beginning of the season?
Yeah, basically, you only really want to run at Cheltenham horses that are good enough and those better races. And actually, funny thing is, this year, with owners not being able to go, one thing that's been eliminated is the pressure from people perhaps who'd like to have a runner at Cheltenham to go to Cheltenham, you know, because it's part of the social thing, it's part of why they have a horse in training, because they can't go now. So there's not pressure from people to run horses, you know, for what I call a social runner and to be competitive at Cheltenham. So you're free, really, to go elsewhere with them. Hence, you can win races wherever else, really, without going to Cheltenham, which is a good thing in a lot of ways.
$50,000 on the table for the Loch Lomond Whiskies National Spirit at Fontwell on Sunday. Now, McFabulous, would you agree that he's up there amongst the most talented horses in your stable?
Oh, without a shadow of doubt, yeah. I mean, he has been from the start. You know, he's great record. I think when he goes chasing, he'll climb even further up. You know, that'll be his job next season. But, you know, this year's been creeping our way along. We tried 3 miles, which didn't really work out. So we thought we'd go for this race here en route to going to Aintree.
And how is he? And would you expect him to win on Sunday?
He should do it. I mean, it's a sharp old track. It's really whatever acts around there. It's not quite like a Newbury or Kempton, but he's got plenty of boot. Brewing up a storm of ollies, won very well the other day. He's sort of favoured by the weights. But, you know, I like to think we'd be progressive and we'd be hard to beat.
Where do you see him in time? What do you think is going to be absolutely his thing?
King George one day. That's what I see him. I mean, I've always said to the owners, work back from a King George one day. I'd like to, you know, go novice chasing next year. We'll end up running over three, I'm sure, at some stage, and could be a horse who could end up following the footsteps of those horses that we've run in the King George's. You know, that's where I see him.
Are there any other profile horses running on Sunday? Obviously, the rest of the card at Farnwell isn't quite the standard of what we've got tomorrow.
Not really. Got some nice chances. Asher Tor runs, who's going to run in the Grand Annual at Cheltenham. He's been off all winter, one of Andy Stewart's, just so it's a prep race for Cheltenham. But really, just that's the feature race, obviously.
Now, tomorrow, you've got a runner or runners in every single race at Kempton. Now, the last time you had that, I think you had about eight winners across the country. So I'm not suggesting you're going to go through the card, but... There are stranger things that have happened.
Well, you know, we've got lots of chances tomorrow. It'd be impossible to go through the card. It's a very, very competitive card. And if we had a couple of winners, we'd be delighted.
Okay, so which horse are you most excited about running tomorrow?
Well, Athol Street's a horse I really love. He's been progressive. He's won his two races over hurdles at Taunton. Was very impressive the last day. This is a step up in class, but we think he's really nice in the heel head to Aintree after this. Tamaractor Matan's a really smart horse, really chasing wise. He won very nicely the first day and then was second to Shiskin over Christmas. He should go well. And the others are all horses got chances, really. Black Horton's coming back for a break. He's fashioned well, was second in the race last year. Wouldn't surprise me if he ran well.
Yeah, Black Horton's rated 158 tomorrow. So he's actually a little lower than he was last year, isn't he?
Yeah. And he ran very well last year, but he's been in and out of form a little bit this year. But he's had a nice long break. He's done everything that Secret Investor had done, sort of thing, to freshen him up and worked along with him. And he's in good shape, but it's always tough for him now. Now he's tend to be carrying top weight in these handicaps against sort of more progressive horses. And one of those might be my other runner, Southfield Stone, who loves Kempton.
Yeah, Southfield Stone also, the ground surely is a thing with him, isn't it? The fact that you're actually going to get decent ground for the first time in ages.
Yeah, that's what he wants. Just one question mark is it's 3 miles and he's never been further than 2.5. But until he goes, you know, I'm sure it'll suit him the way he runs and the way he travels. But he should be okay. But it's a competitive old race. That looks, you know, it does look competitive. But he's in there with a show.
Now, the one horse you haven't mentioned is Paso Doble, who is unraced for you and has come, I'm guessing, from the flat to run for you in the juvenile hurdle. Now, you've done this before to good effect, including last year with Solo.
Yeah, we did. Well, Solo had had plenty of experience. He'd run a few times. He'd run twice over hurdles and won in second, so he was experienced. He's a little bit like Zarkander, this horse, in that, you know, he hasn't had a run over hurdles. And going back to those days, I remember saying to the lads who own Zarkander, well, we'll run him in a good race. If he wins, we can carry on as an office. If he doesn't, we'll save him for next year. And this horse is very much the same. He'd been quite busy on the flat. We gelded him. He took a while to get over that. He probably isn't quite as forward as Zarkander was, and I'd be interested to see him run, but I just got a gut feeling that he'll be next season's horse, and he may run a nice race and we'll leave him till next year.
All right, Paul, well, it's a pretty busy weekend. I appreciate your time as always, and we will catch up again soon.
Yeah, thank you, Nick.
Well, it seems a long time since I was in Riyadh last week talking to you from outside the stone steps of the grandstand, but it's been nice to be back home. And a time now to have a little reflection on the world's richest horse race in the company of James Willoughby, because we spoke about the rankings going into the race. James, did Mishriff's victory over Shelleton have a meaningful impact upon the TRC Global Thoroughbred rankings?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a result, Nick, we take very seriously indeed at the global level. Mishriff earning a new TRC computer race rating, which is our replacement, our substitute for Racing Post ratings, that power the rankings, of 125 on the same scale as the world's best racehorse ratings. And that places Mishriff as an early contender to be one of the top ranked horses in the world by the time 2021 is all said and done.
Were you impressed and or surprised by his victory and the manner of it?
Yeah, I was, definitely. I think that it was helped somewhat by the way the race was run. Now, I say that first of all, because Mishriff finished at 93% of his overall speed for the race, which is below what you would expect if you were going to try and run a track record over 9 furlongs round Riyadh on the dirt. And I think that was because that Charlatan and Nick's Go took each other on earlier. I believe that this is the key to understanding the race at a technical level, which is, I think the American jockeys need to just slow down a little bit in the way they run around this track, because I think that position and early pace aren't so much of a factor round Ryde as they are around some of the American tracks. And I think the reason for that was spelled out by John Gosden in a fascinating post-race essay on the what happened to Misriff, which is that I think the kickback is clearly better. And although Misriff copped some of it early on, I think position, the reason that horses in American dirt races can run inefficiently and win is that track position counts as so much more because of kickback. Now, absent that kickback, and the dynamics of dirt racing move closer to turf. And that's the reason a European turf horse like Misriff could adapt, apart from the preparation that John Gosden deserves credit for giving him. And I think Charlatan, to me, is marginally the best horse in the race. And I'm a big believer in this horse. I just don't think he was ridden optimally on the day. It could turn out that he's more of a dirt mile horse than a classic horse himself, but he's got a ton of pace. And I thought his Malibu Stakes win was awesome. I would rate him here marginally the best horse in the race over Misriff, but Misriff himself now is building up an awesome portfolio.
And from the rankings point of view, where does he climb to?
Yeah, he's in the top 15, Nick, now, and that's partly because the only previous piece of recent evidence was, of course, him sinking in the mud at Ascot. And when we look back at that meeting now, I think we've got some serious questions to place to the Ascot executive. I'm a massive supporter of Ascot racing. I love going there and everything about it. But when you look back at Champions Day, it's time for them to admit that that was a mistake. They should have done what John Gosden said and switched it to the inner track, because it wasn't just that Stradivarius, Palace Pier, there was Dream of Dreams, Sir Michael Stout's sprinter, also sunk in the mud, and notably Misriff. And if you have a horse, Nick, who you can take to the desert and can cope with running on a dirt surface, but can't cope with running at the best race course in Britain because of ground conditions, I think that really begins to question the integrity of the results on Champions Day. And you cannot have that.
So hopefully Misriff will have some more suitable targets, more friendly targets during the course of 2021. John Gosden has nominated the Judmont International as that elusive British Group 1 that I know the owner wants. If you were to plot your way through the campaign with him building up to a huge autumn target, how would you play?
Well, I think that seems suitable. I agree with going back to turf first and foremost. I do not think Misriff owns the all-round game to be a proper world-class dirt horse in America. And I will be taking him on if he returns for the Breeders' Cup Classic at Del Mar. Now, what interested me about his pedigree when I looked through it was, of course, Make Believe, his stallion, who otherwise the son of McVie himself, who hasn't got any of the horses of the stature of this fella. We must remember he's a son of Dubawi, so he's yet another McVie's. So that there's more evidence yet of this ability of Dubawi and his sons to get dual purpose horses or all surface horses, and I think that gives Gosden the versatility to do what he wants with Misriff back on turf in Britain. It could be that a mile and a half is maybe just a little bit too far for him, ideally in a strongly run race. He hasn't tackled that trip yet, but he's essentially a horse that is very, very tough and will battle. And he wants to get into a race where those qualities are really accentuated. Round York, if it was very fast, then he could be vulnerable in a race like that.
Okay, so if there was a race that was tailor-made for him, which do you think it would be?
Well, first and foremost, I think if he was okay, I'd send him to the Dubai World Cup. That seems the obvious target now he's out there. But if that's not in the mind of connections, I don't see why Royal Ascot and the Prince of Wales Stakes wouldn't be the early target for him. It would seem that notwithstanding his flop round there, which we're putting down to ground conditions, it would seem that a really tough track like that is absolutely ideal for him. It's not that he's devoid of pace at all. It's just by top-class standards, I believe he'll be suited by a really strongly run race. We saw that in Saudi Arabia.
And finally, James, do you believe that Misriff and Charlatan will end up the year in the top 10?
Yeah, without a doubt. These are two of the world's best horses. And what a breath of fresh air to actually see them in competition. In recent years, the distribution of talent has been such that the best horses have generally been kept away from each other. It's races like this one, the Saudi Cup, that we live for. as aficionados of the sport. And what a treat it served up. It's one of the best races that I can remember for a while. And I really look forward on both sides of the Atlantic to watching these two wonderful horses, Charlatan and Midship. And don't forget Nick's Go. He was turned away in a speed duel, really, with Charlatan. It's no disgrace for that to happen. He'll be backing himself, and I could see him making a big impact in the handicap division back in the States.
James Willoughby there on the Saudi Cup, and it'll be fascinating to chart the progress of both Mishriff and Charlatan during the course of the season, both in the UK and in the US. Now, the ethics of gambling and the funding of horse racing has come under significant scrutiny in the UK, and indeed talked about extensively on this podcast, with the Gambling Review in the UK, the Gambling Commission's report, and the potential for affordability checks to appear on the horizon. With that in mind, I thought it interesting to avail you of what's been happening in Kentucky. Now, those of you who are listening in Lexington and the surrounding area will be quite well familiar with this, and that is that the Kentucky House of Representatives has voted to re-legalize what is called historical horse racing. It's a slot machine style of gambling that was taken down by the state Supreme Court last year. Now, this is very important to the horse racing industry because the industry says that these machines have buoyed racetracks and revenue has then trickled down to trainers, breeders, farms, and everybody else. Now, one of the key drivers behind this was Senator Damon Thayer, who is the floor leader of the Kentucky Senate and joins me now. Senator Thayer, just explain exactly why these historical horse racing machines are so important to the financing of Kentucky horse racing.
Hello, Nick. I'd be happy to do so. Thanks for having me on your show. Parimutuel wagering here in the States is the mother's milk of horse racing. It drives the purses, which drives the economic model for the way horse racing works here in the States and really throughout North America. So back in 2009, I requested of our then Attorney General to opine on the legality of historical horse racing machines, which are parimutuel machines that are guised to look like a slot machine, but they are pooled together and are parimutuel, and the results are based on historic horse races or previously run horse races. The Attorney General opined that it was legal as long as it was regulated by the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission. So a year later, the first machines were installed at Kentucky Downs, and then they've gone to be installed at almost every track in Kentucky. And there were several court cases where the court sided with the backers of the games that they were indeed parimutuel. So along the way, through the last 10 years, like you said, they have buoyed purses in Kentucky. They have driven our purses to historic highs, and we're on the cusp of having the best year-round racing circuit in the country. It's, you know, previously, you know, we were sort of known for the spring and fall meets at Keeneland and then Derby Week at Churchill Downs, and then the occasional Breeders' Cup at Keeneland or Churchill every few years. But now, with the growth in our purses, we're really challenging New York, California, and Florida to have the best purses in the country. And it's also, from a cost of living point of view, easier to do business here than it is in many other states. But last fall, as you noted, our Kentucky Supreme Court reversed itself from a 2014 position and said, in a really shocking 7-0 position, that the games needed to be legalized by the Kentucky General Assembly. And that is to simply state that these games are parimutuel, like live racing, like simulcast racing, like advanced deposit wagering. And so we then began the very difficult task of passing that through the Kentucky General Assembly. And as you noted, a couple of weeks ago, the House passed Senate Bill 120. That means the bill started in the Senate, where I serve. We passed it over there and then sent it on over to the House of Representatives, where we had to put together a bipartisan coalition of Democrats and Republicans to pass the bill. And it was difficult to do. We have Republican supermajorities in the House, where there are 75 Republicans to only 25 Democrats. Of course, the Republicans would be your version of the Conservative Party, and the Democrats would be your version of Labor. We are a heavy Republican state. And where I serve in the Senate, we have historic highs of 30 Republicans and 8 Democrats. We have a Democrat governor, Andy Beshear, who was elected in a plurality and sort of a fluke election in 2019, where our Republican governor was booted out because he was highly unpopular, not because of what he did, but more because of what he said. So those are the facts. We had to put together a bipartisan coalition because we have a lot of rural Republicans who believe that it is morally or religiously wrong to engage in gambling. So we put it together. We had put together a pretty good coalition that passed the bill. The horse industry put together a really unprecedented advocacy effort to lobby legislators to pass the bill. And then this week, it was signed into law by Governor Beshear. So that's good news. And we know that Turfway Park, under its new ownership of Churchill Downs, will begin building a new grandstand, clubhouse, and historical horse racing facility. Kentucky Downs, in partnership with Keeneland, is going to build a new harness racing track in Corbin. So we feel like we're really back on the beam of getting this thing back on track, if you will, to have the best year-round circuit here in another 1.5 to 2 years.
Okay, so your centrist coalition, if you like, your centrist libertarian coalition with the Democrat governor, Andy Beshear, has managed to face down both the puritanical left and the heavy religious right in Kentucky, which is no mean achievement. And Kentucky horse racing, as a direct consequence of this, is going to be massively on the up because money is going to flood in. But to what extent now, Senator Thayer, do you and your colleagues have a responsibility to ensure the ethical playing of these games? To what extent do you have a responsibility to police this yourself so as not to be seen as a conduit to problem gambling?
That's a really good point, because no one has said that for the last 10 years the games were poorly regulated by the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission. Quite the opposite. I think Kentucky has an industry-leading regulatory body that other states are following. The games have been legalized in places like Wyoming and Virginia, the original state where it started, in Arkansas. The games are under consideration in Michigan and in Georgia. So we've got a very strong regulatory body in place, but we do have a bill going through the Senate that we're going to take up later this week that will require that the Horse Racing Commission follow the rules of the Executive Branch Ethics Commission. And I have an amendment to that bill that I'm going to be offering to make sure that we don't go too far to the extreme to make it so nobody who knows anything about horse racing can serve on the racing commission, because we want people who can serve that understand the racing and breeding industry. We're just going to put in a stronger transparency and disclosure mechanism. So we're going to make sure that we can continue to sort of self-regulate, but put in some stronger rules for transparency and disclosure, because we want people to serve on the racing commission. By the way, those positions are appointed by the governor, that know something about racing, but we're just going to make it so they have to follow some executive branch ethics rules in terms of disclosure and transparency.
Because you cannot simply be seen to be running machines that are just essentially a tax on the poorest in society.
Well, that's right. And that's one of the arguments that both the right and the left used. It's kind of odd for me to be described as being part of a centrist coalition, Nick, because I have a 91% lifetime score with the American Conservative Union, tied for best in the Kentucky State Senate. I'm a traditional Reagan Republican, but I vote for bills to support the horse racing industry and the gambling on it, and I also support bills to support our bourbon industry, you know, so our two signature industries, because I believe in removing artificial barriers to free enterprise. So I always sort of chuckle when people say I'm part of a centrist coalition, but coming from you, I'm going to take that as a compliment. If I lived in England, I would definitely be a member of the Conservative Party, probably to the far right of the Conservatives too. So, we're going to make sure that we can continue to have our industry-leading regulation of these games. And look, nobody puts a gun to the head of anybody to force them to make a bet on our lottery or on a live horse race or to walk into the Red Mile or Derby City Gaming which is Churchill Downs' facility, and play these historical horse racing machines. You know, God gave us free will to decide what we do for ourselves and how we are to spend our free time and our leisure dollars. That's sort of the libertarian streak in me coming out.
Yeah, I think some of your more zealously religious Republican colleagues may question your invocation of the Lord as regards what you should do with your money.
Oh, they have, and they will, but that's fine. And I appreciate the support of the 30 members of my caucus who have made me Senate Majority Floor Leader for going into my ninth year now. I think they know that I told them way up front where I was going to be on this bill. And you're probably right. Some of them do question my philosophy as regards to how we spend our money. But I'm a big believer in free will. And like I said, a little bit of the Rand Paul Republican coming out in me.
But bottom line, the impact on Kentucky horse racing is going to be very, very significant here.
Well, our purses have been on a 10-year upward trajectory where year over year our purses go up. And once Churchill Downs rebuilds Turfway, right now there is no live attendance at Turfway, not because of COVID, but because they tore down the 60-year-old grandstand and clubhouse. So they have a historic horse racing position in Newport, or basically, you know, in the shadow of the Cincinnati skyline, and then they have advanced deposit wagering. But once they get this gleaming new facility open, probably in 12 to 18 months, you're going to see the wagering go up in northern Kentucky. That will drive purses. And then the facility down in south central Kentucky along I-75 between Lexington and Knoxville, Tennessee, that Kentucky Downs and Keeneland will build in Corbin, you're going to see these machines continue to generate more revenue. And you take that to combine it with the Red Mile, the Lexington facility that Keeneland and Red Mile operating, Derby City Gaming that Churchill is operating, Kentucky Downs, and the facility at Ellis Park. Even in the midst of COVID, our year-over-year numbers that we're seeing come out of those facilities are up, even though they're operating under less attendance COVID protocols. So once we get past COVID and we're allowed to go back to traditional capacity, and I think we're probably months away from that occurring as the vaccine is rolled out, I mean, there is nothing but blue sky ahead for the horse racing and breeding industry in Kentucky.
Senator Damon Thayer. My thanks to Senator Thayer. Hope you enjoyed that. And before him to James Willoughby and, of course, to Paul Nicholls for cantering through his many runners this weekend. Something for everyone, Dave Yates, on today's podcast. I don't suppose, however, that there are likely to be historic horse racing machines or slots of that kind feeding their vast riches into the pari-mutuel system in the UK to bolster purses.
No, it's funny how the winds blow in completely different directions, isn't it, in terms of wagering in Britain and in Kentucky, because, as you say, the way that things are going here, that seems a very unlikely thing to happen indeed. But it's fascinating that. It's fascinating to listen to how an activity can be so differently perceived in another, a different, but in many ways a similar part of the world. And it sounds like it's going to... we were talking earlier about racing's coffers being hit. It sounds like this will be a significant shot in the arm to the coffers of racing in Kentucky.
Mm, interesting stuff for sure, and certainly throwing up some interesting ethical arguments as we've been having over here as well. You've got a winner to send us home.
I'm afraid Tuesday's selection lost, Nick, which wasn't lost on David Wilkinson, who was listening to the NLD. He very kindly contacted me by Twitter to say, great podcast, apart from the abysmal tipping of your guests. Well, David, this one's for you. It's Lily the Pink in the 345 at Exeter, a horse of Anthony Honeyball's, successful last time at Fontwell, I think can defy a rise in the weight. So drink a drink a drink to Lily the Pink, Mr. Wilkinson. She's in the 345 at Exeter.
And if she doesn't oblige, David Yates will be on the scaffold by the end of the day. Thank you very much for listening. That was the Daily Podcast on Friday. We will see you again after the weekend. Bye-bye. We'll drink, 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 drink.
this'll come about. Most efficacious in every case.
You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you in association with FitzDares, the Racehorse Owners Association, and Thoroughbred Racing Commentary.